Well, John Patrick doesn't need much of an introduction, but if you don't remember, he retired from the University of Ottawa in June 2002, associate professor in clinical nutrition in the Department of Biochemistry and Pediatrics there for 20 years. John did his medical training in London, England, extensive research in the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiencies and related disease during appointments in Britain, West Indies, and in Canada. He's also worked in Central Africa, assisting in the development of training programs that deal with childhood protein energy malnutrition. But what we know him as is a tremendous apologist, someone who can help us understand the trends of our day and how to express our views in ways we may not have thought of. And you know, when you get John on, all you got to do is turn him loose. And that's what we do with this interview. What are you talking about these days?
Well, the same things as ever in many respects, of course. How do we connect these four areas of life, you know, ethics, culture, faith, and public policy? And finding good news and bad news, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The evangelical community in North America is large, but its level of education is low. But it's coming up quite surprisingly in various areas, and particularly amongst some younger people, and that's really delightful for me. You know, I really feel I can retire in a year or two. You know?
Well, you've been promoting that. You've been training people. I mean, you're beginning to see some of the effects of your efforts, and I know others have been involved as well, but you've been the prophet crying in the wilderness here.
It really is interesting to watch what's going on at that level. And amongst university students, too. I mean, you can say to any university audience, I know you all hate divorce. Nobody will bat an eyelid.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be shocked initially, but they won't say no. They'll say yes. Because if it hasn't happened to them, it's happened to their friends.
Right.
And the next question is, has any child ever enjoyed the divorce of its parents? And of course, the answer's got to be no. The divorcees, meanwhile, are getting uncomfortable. But I say, if you have divorced, then don't ask your children to say it's all okay. It isn't. But do ask them for forgiveness. They'll forgive you because they love you.
Mm-hmm.
But the way forward, as always, is through repentance and forgiveness. Not through asking the church and everyone else to say, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
And if we had held the line on that, how different the state of the church and the state of our children would be now.
How do we hold the line in this day and time? I mean, how do we deal with individuals that are going through this? I, yesterday on the plane, sat down next to a member as we were coming, flying in, and asked about his family. And he said, oh, my wife and I are getting a divorce after 16 years, have no children, but, you know, this divorce has come. It is just so common and sad, and many of our members have been through it. Let's dig into that a little deeper, because I think it's an important topic.
I think that at the heart of it is the fact that we have substituted doing for being, particularly in the evangelical church. We like to do things, don't we? We like projects.
Mm-hmm.
But God has no needs. So why is this so primary? What's primary is that we should know him. And that relationship has got to be central. And it hasn't been. It hasn't been in my life. I think the leaders of movements like CMDA, people like you, have done much better than people like me. To go into academia is asking for trouble. And it's all about doing again. The dean doesn't care about who you are. He cares about how many grants you have and how much money you bring in and how much you publish. So we have become destructively busy. And the church thinks that way too. The phrase I like is that the enemy has got an outpost in our heads. And once he's done that, he doesn't need to do anything else. And one of the fundamental things that we've got wrong is this issue of sort of, we say we're all about grace, and then we live as though it's all about works. That won't do.
Yeah.
And our evangelism is reduced as well into the post-endarkenment view that if you have a set of propositions and you explain it in this way, then it's proved. But our sense of what knowing is cannot be got at by the endarkenment. And yet we could persist in trying to present the gospel as though it could, instead of confronting them with the fact that there are things out there which we know and they don't, and they can't know them through science. If that hadn't happened to the extent it has, you wouldn't see people feeling intimidated by Dawkins and Dennett. They'd be feeling sorry for them. And they're feeling intimidated. I mean, the angry atheists are really making inroads in the U.S. You look at the New York bestsellers list, and rubbish goes to the top of the list routinely, but now it's atheistic evangelism that's going on, and we don't know how to deal with it. And again, it's going back to basics. If we had kept to the Christian view of what is central to life, and for Paul, it wasn't what people could do, it was what their character was in relation to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1 Timothy 3, there isn't a skill in the list, yet we persist in looking for people with particular skills for particular jobs as the first choice instead of the second. Sure, you need skills for jobs, but first, you need character.
Right.
I mean, how many evangelical ministries in the U.S. have blown up because of the failure to get this right?
It's interesting you say that, John, because Gene and I, when we do our hiring here at CMDA, we have a little litany we go through, and the first thing we look at is character. The second we look at is chemistry. Is this person going to be able to work with who we already have here? And third, we look at competence, because you can teach competence, but you can't teach character overnight. And that is the key to fruitfulness in ministry and someone who's going to stay the course because of their calling.
Yeah, and character, of course, is caught before you go to kindergarten almost.
Yeah.
To a very large degree. What happens to us in those early years is so fundamental. I don't know when the divorce epidemic really started in the U.S., but when I was growing up, divorce was unheard of in the working class. It just didn't happen. And I didn't see my first drug addict till I was in my 20s. You know, those are markers, aren't they, of huge changes?
It has, and it's so common. It's endemic in our culture, and we begin to accept it as the new norm.
Well, what we've done is accept me as the center of the argument.
Yeah.
Which is what the endarkment did. It got rid of God and then thought he could carry on as though there would be no problem. Now, for a while, of course, he did, because all the early scientists were, in fact, deeply committed Christians, or the vast majority of them, well over 90%. The early 17th century scientists were Christian. It was the 18th century when scientists began to become tacitly atheistic, and the whole society, too. Well, you can't think that if you do that, that the world will go on being nice as it was before. Again, because we don't know our history, we don't have a sense of how grateful we should be for so many things. One of the books I've read recently is David Hart's Atheist Delusions. And he does a lovely job of pointing out what Christianity contributed to the Western world. And he also, without making much of it, but it fits in with what I'm saying, points out, for instance, that hospitals had never been seen in the world till after Christ. But they still took a couple of centuries to emerge. And the first thing that emerged was much better family relationships. They stopped getting rid of their babies, and they started picking up exposed babies of others. And the church began to build around those commitments to one another. I have said I will do this, I will do it. Marriage isn't done that way anymore now. Even Christians are having marriage contracts. And starting off, what should we do when we break up? I mean, this is not the right way to go about it. And essentially, I think the key mistake in the Protestant church was the acceptance of contraception. I know this will upset a lot of people, but once you have said to God, I do not think that all your gifts are good for me, you really have made a very fundamental theological statement, haven't you? And that's what contraception says. It says, I want you to be in charge of all my life except my fertility. Now, everybody knows that a child looks like a problem. But the early church, if we knew our history, would have taught us, no, it isn't. What a child does is create community. And when that community is really established, then you start seeing things like hospitals and leprosaria and education start to spread in a way that they've never done before. And the last good pagan emperors, one of their complaints was, the Christians are too good. When did anybody last say that about us? In that sense, they wanted to keep... They were pagans, and they didn't want paganism to disappear, but the pagans didn't do anything, and the Christians did, so the Christians won. But they did it out of that context of come to a new understanding of what their relationship with God was, and that it was one of trust. Now, when I first talked about this a good few years back now, I thought, well, this will go down like a lead balloon. And with most people, of course, it has. People have been thinking a particular way all their life are not going to thank me for saying perhaps it was a mistake. But the young are thinking about it. There's a lovely Bible study that Ty Hopkins runs in Virginia Tech, for instance, which is a Bible study for medical students who are coupling or thinking of coupling or already coupled. And I went there just after the shootings a few years ago, and one of the things I must have talked about on that trip, though I don't remember it, is in fact this aspect of life. And the last time I was there, he said, come in on Thursday night, because I have a Bible study group you'll enjoy. And there was a lot of babies produced by that group. And that had come out of, apparently, my visits some 2 or 3 years before. And none of them were complaining. I mean, the best time to have a baby, if you're in medicine, is medical school. You're never going to have a better time than that. And you're not going to fail after year one. You can't afford to fail. You spend too much money on you. And a baby puts the pseudo-anxieties of training in medicine into perspective in seconds when you get home, doesn't it? That's what a baby does. Especially a two-year-old boy leaping on you from great heights and being absolutely sure that you're going to catch him. You know?
Yeah.
We have lost that. We say we're child-friendly, but we've got a long way to get back to that early church that expected people to have fertility and therefore expected them to need help from the rest of the congregation. Now, we're going to have to learn that with the economy tanking. I mean, our youngsters can't get their houses they want when they want, and their debts are going to terrify them for the next 20 years, aren't they? So the church is going to need to become much more practically supportive in these areas, and that will bring the passion back.
You know, when you talk about the marriage issue as well, you know, I think the other thing you've touched on is the whole area of commitment. We just got back from Greece, and we were in Philippi and visiting that site, and went there in the agora, the town square where the temples were and the government and all the rest of it. And there was the temple to Caesar, and they shared that they took the Christians in there, gave them a handful of incense, and said, burn it and say, and Caesar is Lord, and you won't go up to the amphitheater where you could see the trapdoor in the floor where they let the lines out to kill them. And it was just a matter of throwing that in the fire and saying those two or three words. And they would not do it, and they died. And that,
and they took their children with them.
Yeah, and took their children with them. And that level of commitment, you know, when you come down to till death do us part, and I realize in divorces it's, you know, there it takes two, and somebody may do everything right and still have their spouse leave them. But that area of commitment to say it's not what makes me feel good, it's not what makes me happy, it's that I have made a commitment before God and I'm going to keep it whatever the cost.
Yes, the desire to hear, well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah.
You and I both go to developing world to see passion.
Absolutely.
It's still there. They don't have the ethics because they don't have the cultural base. And that's our job, to teach them what they have to do next. And again, it's about the family. In Africa, men haven't even heard of the fact that they should be involved with their children before puberty in most places.
Well, when we were in Greece, I asked about the abortion issue, and they said in Greece there's 300,000 abortions a year and 150,000 live births.
Yeah.
So for our two out of every three babies are killed. And
they're one of the countries that's going to disappear.
Yeah, absolutely. And part, some of the issues they're facing is not just the financial issues, but the things they're facing because of the moral issues in the family and what's happened in that country. So,
yeah.
What do you see in the U.S. as we are dealing with all these issues?
The good news is that people know that we're not getting better, we're getting worse in many respects. There is a sense that we are living empty lives.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, I was listening to a program on the Canadian equivalent of PBS, and Francis Fukuyama, the guy from Stanford who's written about trust and about the end of history, was being interviewed by a good interviewer, but he missed an amazing line at one point when Francis Fukuyama was just sort of musing for a moment, and he said, you know, justice is very difficult without transcendence.
Hmm.
And Pakin didn't pick it up, because what would a liberal think that meant? But obviously Francis Fukuyama has understood the fundamental problem that Nietzsche said, when God is dead, don't think we're going to carry on as we did before. If there is no God, then there are plenty of times when compassion is not in your own self-interest. You shouldn't do it. He wanted the triumph of the noble savage, in fact. And that's, of course, what will happen. And we can see that happening in the underclasses who have been deprived. It's particularly bad in England. You read something like Dalrymple's Life at the Bottom and what has happened in Britain over the last 40 years, where so many people have been enculturated into a culture which takes no responsibility. Everything that happens to them is somebody else's fault. You see that in the poor here too, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the rich as well, oftentimes.
Yeah. But the residents, seeing the same patient who says, yes, I'm going to do better next week, knowing perfectly well they're not going to do better. They're going to go on with their drugs. They're going to go on with their eating habits. They're going to go on with their laziness. But the realization that that is the problem can, in fact, I think, set us up for a situation where we might become more open to God in a really much deeper way. The book that's probably had the most influence on me in the last little while is a book called Why Believe, which you and I think many of your members would enjoy greatly. It's by a man called John Cottingham, who's a retired professor of philosophy at Reading in England and a fellow of St. John's College, Oxford. And I think I can honestly say it's the most beautiful seduction into faith that I've ever read.
Hmm.
He doesn't get to conversion till two-thirds of the way through the book. And he amazingly begins with, well, what are the benefits of faith? And, of course, there are lots of benefits to faith. And he does that beautifully. Societies that have real faith do better than ones that don't. People who have faith live better lives. We know that from the health point of view and various other points of view. As long as we start looking at the things that matter, really, you know, love, joy, peace, the real virtues of living. So he begins by saying, well, you've got to be somewhat arrogant not to recognize that almost all humans throughout the whole of history have felt a need to pray. So we shouldn't be ashamed of the fact when we feel the same way. And he talks about the benefits that flow from that. It's really very beautifully done. So I thoroughly recommend it. In fact, I was given it in Michigan by James Paternoster in the fall. And I read it quickly twice, and I've written a précis of most of it now. That's how much I value it. Now, there's a lovely little anecdote that to slip in there, which you will enjoy too, because whilst I was in Michigan, one of our graduates from Augustine College had just started medical school in the fall in Ann Arbor. And about 6 weeks into the program, one of the professors got offline and made some rude comments about pro-life people, saying that they actually lie about the nature of abortion. It's essentially trivial in the early stages and there should be no fuss. And lovely young graduate raised her hand, and the professor noticed and said yes. And she said, sir, if pro-life people lie about the nature of abortion, then that's a problem they should fix. But what you have just done is an ad hominem attack, and that's disgraceful. And he was stopped dead in his tracks, muttered, and went on. But most importantly, immediately afterwards, she found that she had brought together evangelical and Orthodox Catholic Christians who were all pro-life. And they found that they'd really got quite a remarkable group, about 40 of them. And I gave a talk while I was there, in a lunchtime talk, and that 40 plus the atheists didn't go to the next formal lecture, but instead came out into the courtyard to have another seminar with me for an hour. And the next morning I had breakfast with the atheist group. That's just under the surface everywhere. So we shouldn't give up by any means, but they are looking for real depth and real content, especially medical students. They don't need happy songs. They need content to live by. And we're not doing too good a job in that area in many places yet.
She's a great demonstration of what a little boldness can do.
With the
training to know what to say. Yeah, absolutely.
She knew that. When an argument was false and knew why it was false, could name it, and he was caught.
Yeah.
That's the good part of the AC curriculum, which really has blown me away. My next dream is that every university town in North America will have its own equivalent of Augustine College, because you only need four people to do it, and you can produce that outcome.
What four are those people are saying? What four is he talking about?
Well, you need somebody who's a Christian philosopher,
mm-hmm.
who knows the history of thought and can teach it from the point of view of what happened when Hebrew and Greek thought came together in Christianity. You need someone who knows about science, because we're a scientistic age. When Dawkins can get away with the nonsense he gets away with, because people haven't understood that explanation in a scientific sense is a process, a mechanism that makes sense of the data we're looking at, but it never deals with primary causes. It cannot deal with first causes. And yet we all need to know about first causes. That's where our discussion should be. We always get sucked into a process discussion, and we lose. That's why they make fools of people who are allow themselves to be drawn into the process of Genesis 1 instead of the fundamental in the beginning, God, and man as a separate creation in terms of his knowledge of God, the image of God. That's where we should never agree to go beyond those two until we've dealt with those. Because without agreement on those two, you go nowhere else. So you need someone who can explain that. And obviously, you need someone who can teach them the history of theology and the church. Now, literature and music and art fit around that. They are the trimmings on the cake, if you like, and they make it very enjoyable. That's really all you need. And in that context, they're going to be taught the key issues that I use as a litany all the while. They will recognize relativism and be able to take it to pieces. They will know how to defend legitimate intolerance. They will know what's wrong with multicultural nonsense. They will be able to defend the sanctity of life. And they will know why Judeo-Christian sexual ethics matter, which leads to marriage and divorce, which is where we started.
Right, where we started. And you've taken his complete circle. You know, the Augustine College has just taken off. I heard through the grapevine you guys had maxed out and didn't hardly have any more room. So I think parents are waking up and realizing this type of education is much more important than what students are getting in most places, even in some Christian colleges.
Yeah.
To get that basis and then move on from there creates a
solid. Well, we just had a summer program for this year, and you know, there's six or so guys who've been there for 10 years, gone through the whole process, and going through it again.
Mm-hmm.
They say, I live for the rest of the year on the conversations I have during that week. One young resident from Britain has been twice now. And she said, I can't get these conversations in this kind of way anywhere else. And I need them to survive. We're too busy again. If you can't find time to take a week off, which is a real holiday, I mean, sure, we make you think, but you have the afternoon off and we have some lovely meals together. It's a nice holiday, but it has real content, which you just had that combination.
Absolutely.
When you teach, and then you visit a place, and especially when you have somebody to show you its Christian roots and what happened. To have walked in Philippi and think that Paul was there, you know. Really, you need to go across the water for this talk, didn't you? That Ephesus is our model. When you read the letter to the church in Ephesus, you think, my goodness, what a good church. And then he says, but I have this against you.
Right.
You lost your first love. And if you don't return, you're toast. And as I understand it, there's never been a church at Ephesus since.
No, and you learn so much. I think that's the thing. It brought the Bible open. You know, you read the Bible, and you read it, and you read it, and you get a lot. But to go and understand the original Greek and see the site, I mean, even when we were in Corinth, and the passage where it talks about women covering their heads, you know, you heard that, all the arguments about women covering their heads and stuff.
Yeah.
And I never really understood it very well until, you know, we had a Greek scholar there saying, you need to understand that all the temple prostitutes shaved their heads.
Yeah.
And that's how you knew they were a prostitute. And many of them were accepting Christ, and people still thought they were prostitutes in the city. So he said, okay, all of you, I want you to wear head coverings so these women will not be embarrassed by their past till their hair grows out.
It was really code for saying, when you're a Christian, you stop being a prostitute.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, it just brought, and that's what you're talking about, these conversations. It gives you new insight into things you really need to be thinking about, and turns your attention towards the really important things in life.
One of the points that John Cottingham makes about a Greek word that I'd never heard of before, never thought had explained in that way. The Greeks have a construction called the gerundif. Now, we say we must love truth, but they have a phrase that truth is to be loved. That's the verbal form. And the virtues are not something we choose to do. They're things that have the property built into them that we respond to, that we know we ought to love.
Yeah.
And think about what would happen if we saw marriage in that way again. On both sides. It's got to be both sides. We're simply not being deep enough about marriage, as Paul says. If this is a model of Christ and the church, then it's got to change.
John, I want to thank you for being with us once again. You have challenged us and stimulated us, and I just appreciate your faithfulness to all of our membership and all the times you've spoken in Augustine College and been on Christian Doctors Digest. You have made a profound impact on the Christian doctors in this country, and I just want to thank you for your faithfulness.
Well, it's CMDA that made it possible. For that, I'm deeply grateful.
God had a little marriage planned when we first got together, and it's done well.
Well, good to talk to you, as always. Thank you.
God bless.
And you too.
You know, you can take John home to your small group, to your Sunday school class, to your church. We have tons of great resources. His Sermon on the Mount series, The Myth of Moral Neutrality, Much More Than a Baby Dies in Abortion, Moral Relativism, The Four Levels of Happiness, Hippocratic Medicine, The Third Millennium. Those are all in Just Add Water DVD series, which have a series of discussion questions at the end, ideal for small groups. We also have a CD sets of Augustine College at CMDA when Dr. John Patrick and Dr. Edward Tingley were here for a couple of years. Just excellent stuff. I love listening to these as I'm going on a long trip. You know, you can put a novel in and listen to it, or you can get something that's really going to help you in dealing with issues of our day, and these CD sets will do that. John also travels and speaks, and I'm sure he'd be happy to consider coming into your locality, speak to your physician's group, grand rounds at your hospital, or speak at your church. But there's another way you can help send him out, because often John gets invitations to go overseas where he has such an impact. And many places that invite him to come do not have funds to help with travel. So we have an account here at CMDA for John Patrick to do travel and speaking around the world. And if you'd like to help with that, just write that at the bottom of a check, John Patrick's International Travel, and we'll go into that count. And you'll be helping to touch the world with great apologetics, as only John Patrick can do.